The 1996 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 335, Everything You Wanted to Know About What Mormons Talk About in Sex Therapy, But Didn't Know You Could Ask. A question and answer session with therapists Mary Beth Raines and Frieda Stewart.
I believe it's 11:15, so let's start. Welcome to this session of the Sunstone Symposium, What Mormons Ask About in Sex Therapy, But You Didn't Know You Could Ask. We'll allow those that are coming in to just take their seats. This session is being taped, as are many others, and as I'm supposed to announce also that admission is by ticket. Let me introduce the session by giving you the history of my relationship with Frieda and her with myself. About 14 years ago, I sought her out for some training in sex therapy, she at the time being only one of two accredited sex therapists in the state of Utah. And I have to say, I learned an awful lot. Since then, the two of us have done a number of other things. We have collaborated on a research project about the sexual lives of married Mormon women, which was published in Sunstone within this last year. We collaborated with another woman, Marge Pett, who is also a friend of ours. And since then, we have regularly gone to lunch. And as lunches go among friends, topics turn around to the same thing, and inevitably in our discussions, she asks me questions about Mormons, and I ask her questions about sex. We are each other's mentor in that respect, and I must say that who knows which is the more complicated arcane of those topics, right? In any case, we thought we might broaden the discussion today, and our intent by sitting here and passing out cards for you to ask questions is so that it truly will be a discussion rather than a lecture. Our experience in groups of people is that if you raise your hand and ask a question, it may be an important and good question, but it will be generally a safe one. And so, given that what most people actually bring to sex therapy they wouldn't consider safe in a group, we ask you to just fill out your questions on cards, and we found that those actually generate lively discussion. Let me introduce Frieda briefly. Frieda has her master's degree in social work from Columbia University. She has her doctorate in social work from the University of Utah, and she is co-founder of the Maryland Sex Therapy Clinic at the University of Utah Health Sciences Center. She is a wonderful person, and she is a mother of three grown sons. I have a master's degree in marriage and family relationships from BYU and a master's degree in social work from the University of Utah, and therefore I declare myself neutral in that respect. I have been in private practice, therapy private practice, for the last 10 or 11 years full-time, and actually hear a lot about things sexual and Mormons, which is one of the reasons I ask Frieda questions. I also have three grown children, two daughters and a son, and I have a granddaughter who I dearly adore.
Oh, dear, I don't have a granddaughter, but I have a daughter-in-law. I'm hoping to have another one before the end of 1997, but who knows?
You can tell how old we are. We shall not announce that formally. We decided to start the session by just giving a brief overview of topics we see coming into therapy again and again. Mormons who come in and want help with some questions and some problems or some issues in their sexual lives, singly or in their marriages or partnerships. And so I'll take the broad view, and she'll answer some of the kind of particular concerns people bring in. By the way, I am Mormon and Frieda is not. And so we get different slants we discovered as we started talking about this.
One of them will each have to take on the male role at different points during the discussion.
That's right.
Here.
That's right. Since we have no male here to join us, there could be no discussion about sex and what Mormons question and bring into therapy if you didn't talk about guilt, right? And that is one of the major issues that comes in somewhere around. Generally, the question is focused in a particular way. I need help with, and then fill in the blank. But the concern almost always centers on, or at least impinges upon, shame or guilt or concern about church authorities or what God will feel or what will happen. And my experience among Mormons is that it's really difficult to separate out what is shame and guilt, and yet the two are very different qualities. One, shame is about a quality of being, your right to do, feel, think certain things, and the other is the actual actions themselves, whether that complies with your moral code or the moral code of the church. And given that, in my view, sexuality and spirituality are split in Mormondom as they are in Christianity and actually in many other religions of the world, it's real difficult to find a connection point between those two, except if you fit within the range of what's acceptable by the church or by the religion. And so that's always a struggle, quite apart from the issues of, I'm this age, I have this problem, my partner will or won't do X, Y, or Z. I also have noticed, as you might imagine, in this whole issue of guilt or shame and so on, another issue, which is what actions the church takes and what reaction people have to that. And I've heard the most amazing stories about what actions bishops and state presidents have taken or not taken, have resisted taken, resisted taking, excuse me, I'm having trouble with my gerunds today, or take impulsively. And I would say this is only an impressionistic view, but my sense is that men and women are treated quite differently. Obviously, as we probably all know, how one is treated according to one's sexual compliance or noncompliance varies widely from bishop to bishop, from state president to state president, from high council court to high council court. But I would say, just as an impression, that men who are in authority, that is, they are from a bishop level or higher, are probably sanctioned less when there's been some sexual infraction. Men who have the priesthood, that is, to the level of an elder, or have been through the temple, but are not in the authority system somewhere, are sanctioned more, if in fact there's something that happens to them. And somewhere, women are in between and seem to be sanctioned for various kinds of things, and there seems to be no general rule, meaning that some very small infractions such as or noncompliance such as wonderful or quite well-developed fantasy life may be sanctioned in some way in terms of probation or not taking the sacrament or so on. To someone, in one case I had a client's husband who had been visited a prostitute for 10 years running and also was just given probation. So it varies widely, I should say. Another topic that I see occurring all the time is a particular sense of trying to find particular techniques or particular way of relating to the church to solve an overall sexual issue or emotional issue. And it requires both. It requires the person to rework their whole sense of who they are as a sexual being. And by the way, I experience men as being far more aware of this than women on a constant basis. Men, and that's actually one of the delightful parts about being a therapist, as it was as a lady missionary, is that you have all kinds of discussions with men you would not have otherwise. And men are very aware on a regular basis about their being sexual beings all of the time. And Mormon women are less aware of that until somewhere around their middle or late 30s, it looks like to me, in which then the huge questions come up that often are arising for men in adolescence or about the time they go on their missions. So that's, for the moment, because we want to keep it short, some of my general observations, and Frieda has some particular ones.
Well, I'll just make an additional comment on the last observation that Mary Beth noted, which is that men, Mormon men, tend to be more aware of their sexual feelings and recognition of themselves as sexual beings than are women. I think that's true across the board for all religions and probably not people who are not religious also. As a rule, still, from early childhood, sexual feelings are much more quickly edited out for women, for young girls than they are for young boys. And I think that boys will be boys philosophy still exists pretty much also across the board. So with that, I'd like to move into things that are a little bit more, what I would call more specific. Most people like to believe that their sexual behaviors and practices and relationships are normal. And especially if there's a sexual problem that is being experienced, then wanting to know your normal becomes even more important. So that, I think, is one motivating factor, not only the discomfort of the experience between partners, but also that question of normalcy that is kind of an undercurrent for many people, helps motivate those to seek out therapy. The common areas of concern for Mormons that I've noted in my practice through the years are threefold, the specific areas of sexual behavior that's questioned. One is masturbation, which creates for many people a struggle within themselves. And also, it can create a struggle between partners. The struggle can be, this is a behavior that I'm doing, even if that partner is comfortable about it, but has keeps it private and secret and is questioning whether the other partner should know. Also, sometimes the other partner does know, either having been told or found out by accident. And for people who can accept that, it remains okay. But for many spouses, when one spouse learns of the other's masturbation, and it's usually the woman learning about the man's masturbation, it sometimes rests very uncomfortable, because if he no longer has the struggle within himself, or even if he does, she may then start to have a struggle within herself, and that enters into the boundaries of the relationship and can cause a great deal of friction. The other area of concern for a lot of people is oral sex. And it's the same struggle. The struggle within oneself, if that's appropriate sexual behavior or not. The struggle between partners, when one insists that it's considered an unnatural sexual activity, and that partner feels on moral grounds and principles that it's not a behavior to indulge in, and it's something that the other partner wants. And this then can is often an area of friction. And the third area that is extremely common is discrepancy in sexual desire, where one partner is much more interested in sex than the other. And usually when that happens, the couple is coming in to make the person less interested more interested. And that particular sexual difference in feeling or interest or motivation is very, very common across the board. And in fact, it's probably a toss-up as to which problems of those that are identified as sexual dysfunctions are presented most often to sex therapists. And it would be somewhere between sexual desire discrepancy and male erectile dysfunction are considered probably the two more common problems today. That changes, and it changes with whomever is reviewing the literature and trying to get the statistics and reevaluate them. So those are the areas I think of as running themes. And behind it are the questions that Mary Beth was raising. What's church approved? But also for many people is what are non-church members doing? What's the rest of the world doing in regard to sexual behavior? And there was a recent book, Mary Beth, do you know? It was published about a year ago. It's a sex survey. It's the most recent one, and it could be the Janus Report, and it was very highly touted. And if you, in general, want to know what the sexual behavior is of Americans, according to that report, not much. I think that's the summary of it, which was really rather surprising, because of course we think it's rampant all over the place. The next thing that I would like to present briefly is to pass on to you my three pearls of wisdom. And this is, no matter who comes in to see me, there are three things that I hope that I can get across. One is that if the partners have the capacity to listen and assume goodwill, that talking about sex and talking about one's feelings about sex with your spouse can be very helpful. It often clears up a lot of misunderstandings, and it can enhance emotional closeness. The second pearl of wisdom is that intercourse, sexual intercourse, is not the only form of true sex. Touching, holding, caressing, genital play, oral sex if it's acceptable, as well as intercourse, are all healthy forms of sexual activity, and that those, when we talk about sex, that equals sex every much as intercourse does. It is not necessary for there to be an erection in order to have a good sexual experience. It certainly is desirable, but it isn't absolutely essential. And third, I think for most people, loving and knowing that you're loved is really much more significant and much more important in the scheme of one's life than making love is. So with
Thanks.
That.
Before we start, I'd like to underscore one of Frieda's points about what's acceptable to both partners by a joke I heard the other day, which I found quite wonderful. A man found himself on a desert island with the requisite brass lamp, and upon rubbing it, of course, emerged a genie. However, the genie was quite tired and said, "You can only have one wish because I'm really just, you know, tapped." And so the man thought a lot, and he reached into his pocket and pulled out a map of the world that he happened to have, and he said, "Well, if I could wish for any one thing, it would be for world peace." And the genie groaned and said, "I really am tired. That's quite beyond." And he said, "Well, okay then." He says, "Why don't you pick something else?" And he said, "Well, okay, then I'll wish for something personal. When I get off this island, I would wish that my wife would be as interested in oral sex as I am." And the genie looked at him and said, "Let's look at your map again." We have three questions, so we'll start with those. And Michael will go around and pick up any others that you might have. Please feel free to be as explicit as you would like, because we are well practiced in saying things explicitly sexual. In fact, I had a good mentoring from a friend of mine who used to teach at the university on classes that include sexual information. She said, "Well, if you have any trouble, you just stand in front of the mirror and say whatever words you're having trouble with again and again and again until you're comfortable." So we have done that. And so please feel free to be as clear as possible. Let's start with this one. And I'll just pass it over to you when I get through. The richest spiritual, joyful moments of life may come in sexual embrace. If that is impossible in a frigid marriage, unresponsive to sexual therapy, what is one to do? Is a tender affair without full adultery appropriate for one committed to not being adulterous and to not breaking up families? Of course, this is a huge conundrum. Many couples face it. My sense is that this is a question that's searching for a particular solution without the person knowing that the answer only emerges out of rethinking the whole problem, rethinking oneself. One of the typical binds that Mormons get into is that if the church says I can or cannot do something, then that concretizes or makes the problem absolute in that sense. And therefore, you only have, you know, one move to the right and one move to the left of only 1 millimeter in length to make. And so you cannot think it beyond that. So then you only cycle between two parts of your being, between what's right and what may be joyful or loving or what feels like loving. And in order to do that, you really have to move to the level of thinking and problem solving that connects and works with paradox, ambiguity, cognitive dissonance, all of those psychological or, you know, theoretical terms, but essentially real in our gut when we're agitated and anxious, right? And so talking to other people, finding ways to integrate those points, my experience is that many people, in fact, probably most people who go through adulthood and allow themselves some autonomy of interest, have one or two friends at least who they really, really like and are good friends. Most people have those of the same gender. Many people have those of the opposite gender. And whether you consider that an affair or not is your own definition, of course. And I've certainly, over the years, dealt with people who have talked about their emotional affairs or their sexual affairs. But one of the crucial things to know in talking with people about this, watching your own process, maybe even finding the help of a friendly therapist or a wise friend who will remain confidential to work out the various ways of doing it. In other words, you can see I'm not going to give you the answer on this, because there isn't one. There isn't one that can be one-size-fits-all answer. One of the important things to understand as you address this whole question is, what ways can I think about it differently? What other ways have people thought about it differently? And what is my personal style about acting before a change of belief or change of thinking of the world, or waiting until I act after my thinking or my understanding of a situation has changed? My experience has been that those people who tend to act before they've really worked with rethinking or understanding an issue oftentimes experience more guilt, more dissonance, and the statistics are pretty clear that for Mormons who are in quite large noncompliance around sexual issues in the church become inactive pretty quickly or pretty easily. They then start to push the question of what do I do with my spirituality, and then answer that either in the negative form or dismissive form or guilt-ridden form. And so essentially in the horns of this dilemma, you have to work both sides. And so if I had any advice, it is to spend time thinking through and talking through and trying to understand it from a different angle before acting in some way so that you spare yourself some anxiety later. However, if you've been pent up for many years, sometimes people don't have the impulse control to do this. So this is, you know, sometimes after the fact. Also, if you have sexualized relationships, that is, closeness and intimacy and talking, if you've sexualized it to the point where you're always sexually aroused, you sexualize a discussion with somebody of the opposite gender or the same gender if you're homosexual, then you actually have a more difficult time than if you don't.
This is a really tough question. I'd like to read the first sentence. The richest spiritual, joyful moments of life may come in sexual embrace. And I would like to add, the richest spiritual, joyful moments of life may come in sexual embrace, but they also may come in other forms. And I think when we are longing for something and missing something, it absorbs so much of our energy and our attention and our focus that we are assuming that that's the only experience that leads to another experience that we want to have. I hope that just made sense. That is, that the sexual embrace becomes the only experience to give us that richest spiritual, joyful moment. But maybe there are other kinds of experiences. So it's that can also provide some of that spiritual, special spiritual quality that you're looking for. So this is another way, I think, of saying really what you were saying in a general way, which is to begin to review what it's really all about. Also, in a frigid marriage, which I'm assuming meaning one partner is totally uninterested in sex, there may be the possibility of some kinds of physical affection. There may be room for that, depending on how safe that person can be made to feel. So that by separating the affection, physical affection, from the more sensual, sexual kinds of pleasure, may be another way to taste a little bit of the experience that this person is seeking. I don't know if that is a possibility. And the latter part of it is a tender affair without full adultery appropriate for one committed to not being adulterous and not knowing and not wanting to break up families. I think that that's a question that also has only a personal answer. One of the difficulties in our significant other relationships is the expectation that all of our emotional needs be fulfilled. And that's a very heavy burden to put on the relationship and on each other. So we need emotional connections in other relationships, among family, among friends, and perhaps among special friends. But I think that is something that each person has to struggle with within themselves.
The question from the audience is, why is it for many people, in the questioner's observation, more women than men, is sex not spiritual and therefore sometimes either difficult or somehow dissonant experience? There's also another question here on the table which is similar to that, except it's about men in the sense that I have a theory that men in the church believe that they have not received any personal revelation because of being out of harmony with God because of personal sexual problems of masturbation. Does that follow from your data? So the question is basically, what's sexual and what's spiritual? Given that there is a split between the sexual and spiritual, it's because of how it's coded. There's nothing to say in my book that something sexual isn't spiritual. What happens with us all sexually and how we interpret it and how we experience it, given that for many people the physiological sensations are somewhat similar, right? Although they may be more intense for others. How we code it, how we interpret it to ourselves in our brain is crucial, and that has everything to do with what emotional stage of development you are currently. Intellectual development is one thing, but most people are not at the same level emotionally that they are intellectually. They have more information, so to speak, in a kind of a younger emotional template. And when you have your religion or your dominant culture that says sex and spiritual are in two different categories, which is true in America, by the way, and Christianity, it's not just Mormons. We just inherited and have embellished upon it. When you have it in two different compartments, you can't see them as similar or where the underlying congruence is between the two. For instance, one commonality for many people who have spiritual experiences and who also enjoy sexual experiences is to say that both are ecstasy experiences. And both have great doorways into joy and have a greater sense of meaning in life. So it's a matter of how it's coded. But that splitting of sex and spirituality is pretty common for developmental stages that are somewhere still around elementary school and middle school levels of development. You haven't started to integrate the two and deal with the dissonance. The problem is that in order to get to the level of seeing sexual and spiritual as similar, you either have to have totally correct experience so that you haven't had any out of bounds, and I've met very few people where that's not the case. Harold Christensen, who studied Mormons' sexual experience over 3 decades, says that Mormons feel more guilt for less variation from the norm than other cultures. So in other words, you're going to have trouble with that. You can't get to the integration place of seeing sexual and spiritual as interconnected or that one's similar to the other, because many spiritual experiences aren't necessarily all positive until you go through a dissonant period, until you go through an adolescence, as it were. And that's difficult, and it's absolutely required that you deal with the big problems, paradoxes, and questions in your own self. Let me say it another way. I've never met a wise person who was innocent. And I think it takes a long way of knowing and taking full responsibility and understanding of your own actions, your own feelings, your own fantasies, your own impulses that come to you without bidding, and incorporate them into your sense of self, your spiritual self, to start experiencing them the same or interconnected. But then there's a twinning, and then they are actually intrinsic to each other. It's just that we have a very limited sense of what is spiritual, and we have a very limited sense of what is sexual. And it takes broader definition and boundary. Now, whether women feel that way more or not, I don't know. What I do know is that this is, you're asking gender questions, as is the person here, and that it's really common for women to want to have a loving or relationship connection, and if they're very spiritually identified, a spiritual okayness about things before they enter into that. That kind of opens their heart and then opens sexual feelings. Many times for men it's in the other direction, meaning they have sexual impulse first, and then I've heard many women say, well, my husband or my partner, you know, kind of gets turned on, and when he really gets turned on and we're kind of into it, then it looks like his heart opens. And I have to say, this is one of the questions I've got to ask God if I ever get an audience, which is, why is it that the wiring is different between the genders on this one? But it's simply a preference, and it's gender-related to some extent in my experience, although many men will experience a typical female pattern and many women a typical male pattern, so I'm not saying it's only one gender. But my experience is that that's often the case for women who are highly spiritually identified. The question for women who will say, I don't want to be sexual unless it's spiritual, is... they often have either a background of sexual abuse, they have a very tight construction of what is spiritual, or there's a power struggle going on in the relationship in which that's the only way one knows how to claim one's authority to what one wants. And so somehow God is bigger than ourselves, and we will invoke him at times when, in fact, we don't know how to invoke our own preference and be our own authority for our own wishes. For men, in terms of... feeling personal sexual problems and having a lot of guilt, I would absolutely agree that most men I have talked to have had some sense about that, because men are, you know, have a lot of sexual impulse and a lot of sexual feeling pretty continuously from sometime in adolescence on, in my experience. In fact, a person of my good acquaintance was a bishop in the MTC for a number of years, and he said that after a time he saw his main function as being this, that male missionaries would come in and sit down, and inevitably half of them in the district would say, well, I couldn't tell this to my bishop because he was my father, or because he and the state president are good friends, or for some reason I couldn't stand it coming out in my family, so I couldn't tell him this. And then he proceeds to tell him whatever it is, from masturbation to sexual intercourse. And this person said, I saw it as my sole function to say, brother, it's done, forgive yourself, the Lord forgives you, clean it out of your mind and go on your mission and do a good job. And I happen to agree with that, in the sense that when you can get something in the past out, by the way, there's a great book called Forgiving the Unforgivable by Beverly Flanagan that has a forgiveness model that I like a lot for self and for others. She focuses it on another person if you're betrayed by another person, but you can use it for yourself. That is a 6-stage model that I like a lot that you might employ.
Yes, I just want to mention something again. By the way, I'll state now that when I speak, it may not necessarily be implied in what I say, may not necessarily be my position. as much as it is hoping to help people think about things differently. And so with that question, there are two prongs that I would like to address. One, taking the distinction, gender distinction, that you were making, which I don't know if that exists or not, but interestingly, which I think in some ways may be connected, that as a rule, it's very important for women to feel love as a very important ingredient of the sexual experience. So that means sometimes for young adults, particularly female, who are experiencing and exploring their sexuality, they may fall in love many times in order to justify the sexual experience. But I'm bringing that in because I think that has that there. That's more gender specific, and I'm not as clear about the issue of spirituality. But that that extra ingredient, loving, may be what in some ways helps connect for the female a sense of there being a part of the experience that is spiritual. The other thing that I wanted to point out is everything we do in our lives identified as being part of our spirituality? Is spirituality a pervasive sense that really is defined by the way we live our lives totally and completely and encompasses all aspects of our lives? And I ask that question because for some people there may be a separation between the spiritual and the sexual, and they can find a place that's acceptable for both. For others, because sex physiologically becomes transcending for many people, therefore it then emotionally becomes transcending. And spirituality is a transcending experience that for some people this integrates and flows freely and easily. But in places that it doesn't, how much does it diminish the sexual experience if a person doesn't identify it as a spiritual experience and yet may be able to identify it as a loving experience?
Yeah, I would say as a real concrete answer, if you just go over this theoretical stuff and you take it back into your relationship, it might be seen as one more power move, right? Well, this is just you trying to get what you want. And if a person sees their spirituality as primarily trying to avoid negative things and therefore be right, then that's not going to help. If they see it as more joyfully based, it's a different thing. But if a person were to go back and say, however you see your spirituality is fine, how would you like to feel loved by me right now? It becomes a much more practical, immediate question that then speaks to what's going on in the relationship that both people would like. The other person could say that, and then you could also list your own preference. Here, I'd like to be more loved by you right now, and see if you can find some bridge where both is acceptable rather than each has to have their own position or you're not going to do anything. So, one more thing.
Trying to live a loving life out of the tree of knowledge of good and
And the audience, respondent was saying that too many people try to live out their life out of the tree of knowledge of good and evil instead of out of the tree of love. I have a piece of advice here, which is that when we from our own current position feel like the church is doing something of another that's too much this or that, and yet we have no direct influence on it, right? That it actually makes more sense to figure out what our current integrated solution is and speak it and model it. That speaking against something in terms of labeling it or naming it is fine, but to stay in that position as the major point of discussion actually doesn't help anything. It just escalates a power struggle. But to say, here's how I've integrated it, or here's what I enjoy, or I see, you know, a wide variety of things, sexual as spiritual, that just speaks it. And then people know it because you've already integrated in the way you say it and your quality of being. And I think that does have an important influence. Let me move on. There are two or three questions that are around very specific Mormon policy issues. And then there are a couple questions that are very specific, you know, sexual interaction issues. So I'm going to speak the religious now, and she's going to speak. I'm going to do the spiritual, and she's going to do the sexual work. Sorry. this question, I will just briefly paraphrase it. In 82, there was a letter to bishops saying that oral sex was not appropriate and people should bring their lives in accordance to into order before a temple recommended could be regarded. What's the process with this? Shortly after that, and there are people I know who have the specific letters. I don't have them at the moment. The church reversed that position and said to the bishops, they sent out another letter over the first president's signature saying, brethren, do not ask about these issues. They are between a couple in their bedroom, and so don't ask. And then about 6 months or a year later, there was another letter that said, brethren, we really mean it. Don't ask. And since then, I think for the most part, bishops, in my experience and of hearing people talk about it, have been really pretty good about that. There are some who I believe still take advantage of their position and then execute essentially an institutionalized voyeurism in asking too much too explicitly. And my experience has been in working with gay and lesbian people that that's very often the case. That most isn't asked, and that if a person is assertive enough to simply say that's a private area in my life, that most bishops won't push the issue. And so it really is a question, I think, at this point of what's okay between the couple in their own bedroom.
Do the general authorities care if a single person masturbates or a married couple masturbates?
Well, I think, you know, I've noticed... Okay, the question is, do general authorities care if a single person masturbates or if a married person masturbates? First of all, I'd say they don't talk about married people masturbating for the most part. So again, you have more availability to a wider range of sexual practices once you're married. When you're... I mean, obviously, what I mean is not just sexual intercourse, okay? Before you're married... You know, they're obviously sanctioned for sexual intercourse. It's how much guilt you feel up to the point of sexual intercourse and discuss it with your bishop, and then it's up to what your bishop feels at that point. And so there's this whole range of negotiations about what you think's okay, what your bishop thinks okay, although there certainly have been church talks, saying that various things are not okay in terms of excessive fondling or petting, or at one point there was even a talk about French kissing. So... you know, there's a whole range of things out there, but we're in this wonderful place, and I'm calling it wonderful purposely, of ambiguity, where you are forced to decide for yourself, which is only to the good in terms of how... then you're forced to grow...
You know about that don't ask, don't tell policy.
Okay. However, the church has become more regressive about masturbation in now... And this is from somebody in my family telling me this was occurring in seminary. So whether this is generally available, I don't know. I haven't heard otherwise. That masturbation is now being termed self-abuse. So in that sense, yes, it would color everyone's experience if that's the term rather than masturbation. Let me answer a couple of quick questions. Have LDS leaders officially or informally reversed their former position that sex is for procreation only? Do they acknowledge and accept the idea that sex has a legitimate role in mutual pleasuring and strengthening the bonds of the relationship, which in turn stabilizes marriage and families? I would say they have informally done so, but officially done so in that. There have been a couple of Ensign articles over the years about somewhat similar to that, and even though it was very euphemistically stated, and that there have been formal discussions much about you only should do it for procreation. In fact, the whole issue around birth control has been much less de-emphasized. And in my opinion, that's how the LDS Church changes its position on many doctrinal issues, and particularly sexual ones, and that is to simply de-emphasize, stop talking about it, and then move on to another kind of focus. The last question is the control of sexual mores the ultimate control weapon used by religion, churches, or clergy, to control and discipline every person? Is such control legitimate? You know, this is going to be a funny answer, but I think it is in the legitimate terrain or domain of religions to control what they theologically and according to policy and practice think they should control. That's part of the premise of division between church and state, and each has their own aegis in each area. I may not personally agree with how a particular religion does it, or how my religion even does it, but it's still within the purview of that religion to do so. The question is how we all then struggle with how they decide it and what the decision-making process is. The question really ultimately is not is everybody controlled, but how controlled do I feel? And how am I allowing, as I move into more mature developmental stages of emotional development, how do I allow myself to feel controlled when if I decide to go along with my church, I in fact am making an adult decision to do so? In other words, in the end, we have to accept the responsibility for our own decisions to live or not live what our religion says we should live. And when we choose not to, we also need to make the adult take the adult responsibility saying, I'm not, for various kinds of reasons, going to do that. My experience in the Mormon Church is that those people who do so comfortably in terms of making up their own mind and not feeling controlled, even when they're in a very tight discipline structure, are those who either have a spiritual life in which they feel like they have an ongoing relationship with God or an ongoing sense of being spiritually nurtured, and their sense of rightness and okayness and beingness continues throughout their life cycle. I've heard many clients say, you know, I'm not doing what the church should say about this and that sexual, but I have to tell you, my spiritual life is doing just fine. You know, I'm feeling all kinds of things from God. I don't, you know, their experience tells them that there's not a split, is what I'm trying to say. The other group of people who tend to do very well, I think, with these dissonant kinds of things and don't feel control are those people who tend to have pretty rigorous thinking processes that helps them discriminate between various ways of seeing things, and that then they work it out over time through the inner dialogue, reading, talking to other people, and find ways in a stair-step way to decide what they're going to live and not live and not feel controlled by a religion who, in their judgment, may be quite restrictive.
So just a little piece to add to that is I think for many religious people, their church is the intermediary between themselves and God. And for some people, they're able to decide that the church doesn't have to be the intermediary between their relationship with God at every level, at every point in life, at every stage of development. And they find a way to have a personal relationship with God that simply does not direct itself through the organized religious body. And I think that's true for many people, and probably most people who have a living sense of spirituality have in some ways at certain times found that they needed to, that experience came in moments when the church was not the intervening body, regardless of what religion that one practices.
We have a number of questions about specific sexual techniques and experiences, and so why don't you?
Okay. Since this is one of the issues that I mentioned early on, let me read. This is first a commentary, and then there's a request at the end. Masturbation is a four-letter word in LDS and many other Christian denominations. The secular orientation of masturbation is that it is a normal part of our sexuality. And that is true. Men generally find masturbation as a rather natural function. Women find masturbation as a vehicle to explore and find their individual unique sexual satisfaction based on anatomical uniqueness, or find that it facilitates relief with menstrual discomfort. I see the LDS and other churches using masturbation as a vehicle for inspiring guilt and control, for the purpose of identifying with religious conviction and authority. Please comment. I almost hate to say this out loud, but philosophically, I believe that most religions, in my rudimentary knowledge of a wide range of them, inspire a certain amount of guilt over whatever the identified sin may be, and that they also inspire closely connected to that, inspire a certain kind of fear and anxiety, because I think that is one of the ways to control the flock. And that takes a whole variety of forms. And it's two-pronged, because whereas on the one hand, religions will use guilt and shame and sin and damnation as one means of control, the other horn of the dilemma is that also equally and hopefully more so preached is love and openness and respect and value for everyone, for the human being and the human condition. And so masturbation may simply just be one of the ways that certain religions use as a control mechanism. Not the Mormons are not the only religion that does that. Catholics also have great prohibitions on masturbation. Onan was considered sinful because he cast his seed to the wind and did not deposit it in a vagina for reproduction, although I think that the Jews have moved away from focusing on that as a sin. But just like there's Mormon guilt, there's also Jewish guilt and there's Catholic guilt, and you can go read Portnoy's complaint and just be inundated about all of the sexual guilt that this character experienced in his development.
There are a lot of Jewish American princess jokes about how Jewish women are not sexual in the same way that you hear about Mormons talk about that women aren't sexual in some ways. Mostly jokes crafted by men, I think. There are a number of sexual questions, so let's move to those. Let me read the first one. My wife reaches orgasm usually by stimulation from a vibrator while I stroke her buttocks. How can I help her feel good about this expression of her sexuality? There are two parts of this question as far as I can see it. One of them is about technique, and the other is about the context between the couple. What goes on sexually between a couple is a microcosm of what goes on generally around every other issue in their life or every other concern in their life. And so if you feel like you need to help your wife, I would first of all ask her if she feels like she wants to be helped, because there's helpers and helpees, and sometimes kindness can be perceived as a power move rather than a genuine concern, so I'd check that one out, okay? But there's a couple of things you can do in terms of techniques. One of them is, have you ever explored using a vibrator yourself? in the sense of stimulating yourself in various ways. And therefore, because some becomes something that both of you use sexually, and it's not just her because that's the way she experiences orgasm. Next, a fairly large minority of women really do only reach orgasm either by orgasm or by extra penetrative means, meaning not through sexual intercourse and penile penetration. And so that is a natural way. Maybe your wife doesn't know that. And I would guess that if you really feel comfortable about it, you enjoy it, or enjoy the process with her, maybe even enjoy watching her and let her know that in a way that, again, isn't trying to help her, doesn't have tension around it, is just an enjoyable process, then over time that might get worked out and not have any kind of struggle in you. It may actually work out with her.
Yeah, I'd like to emphasize one point that Mary Beth said, and it went too fast for me. In the statistics that we have, of the women who experience orgasm, 30% of those women experience orgasm during sexual intercourse. The other 70% of women who experience orgasm, that is, with their partners, in the presence of their partners, will do it through manual stimulation or oral sex, or maybe touching themselves during part of the love play. So the orgasmic experience for women during sexual intercourse is not the norm. We think of it as the norm because our sexuality is, meaning our culture's sexuality, is based on a male model of sexuality. And that's the way men experience their orgasm primarily, is during intercourse. But what we have to remember is that's just the perfect experience for men. A nice, warm, cozy place, the right amount of friction, often a little bit of fantasy, and it's just what men need to have their climax. The vagina is much more sensitive to fullness and pressure, but there's not the same kind of innervation that there is in the clitoris and the labia, which is the much more, when stimulated, highly arousing part of the female anatomy. Often during intercourse, the clitoris and labia may be stimulated by, depending on the position of intercourse or whether you're humping or grinding. If you think about it, most men will tend to have climax when they're humping. Women, even during intercourse, like to grind a lot, so as opposed to the thrusting. So there, you have to put it together in a way that gives both partners varying degrees of pleasure. Now, intercourse is often very pleasurable for women, but it may not be the most arousing part of the sexual experience.
And since men and women, from beginning sexual interest to orgasm, vary widely in terms of time, to go from 0 to 60, so to speak, takes men on the average of, 3 to 5 minutes, and women 15 to 20. Sometimes there is not an exploration or time taken with the couple to simply allow what in the woman's natural increase of desire and interest to go from the excitation stage to the plateau stage of where there's a high arousal but not yet reaching climax, to allow that to occur naturally, or for her to find her own natural sequence or ways of coming to that level. There's an analogous question here you want to read that?
Okay.
You know more about that than I do.
What constitutes experiencing orgasm from a female perspective? Is there a continuum of experience that counts as orgasmic? Okay, there's a variety of questions here. Let's start with that. The experience of orgasm does not provide the same physiological sensations consistently. Orgasm does not usually feel the same consistently. I think of orgasm as going from a whisper very soft and gentle, kind of like little waves, to something very loud and intense. And it's felt in different parts of the body. For many women, orgasm is concentrated in the pelvic area, as tends to happen also for men. But also for many women, they experience the orgasm almost more in their head than in their pelvis. Or it may be something that washes through their whole body, sometimes very intense and very strong, and sometimes very softly. Physiologically, orgasm is a series of contractions of the muscles of the pelvic floor. The uterus also contracts. That, by the way, is why sometimes after hysterectomy, women's experience with orgasm may be less intense, because here is this uterus that had been there that offered strong contractions, rhythmic contractions that were part of the orgasmic experience, and now that it's removed and those contractions are removed, there's not as many areas of the pelvic in the pelvis that are contracting, so the orgasm may be less intense. But there can be, I'm not sure quite how to interpret this, a continuum of experience that counts as orgasm. That's not quite clear to me.
She might be speaking to the very thing you are, which is there are a wide variety and kinds of, rather than a continuum. I don't know. Although I would like to interrupt for just a minute to say that it's common for women to experience at different life stages different quality to orgasm. And one of the nice things about women and sexual things is that we not only have women's groups and talks about a lot of things, but we also talk a lot about sex with each other. And we tend to talk about it quite explicitly, although most of us, in my experience, try to be careful about our partners and not talk about our partner, but about our own experience. It's just sort of a little ethic about that. And what occurs many times is that women in their 40s and 50s will say, well, the quality is different, or it's not as profound, or I don't experience orgasm through my whole body as much as I did. And one of the reasons for that is that the muscles in, through your whole body, of course, start to become more relaxed unless you use them regularly, and the muscles in your pelvic floor that support a more intense or stronger orgasmic experience also do. So those very Kegel exercises that you are prescribed by your pediatrician after the birth of a child, if you have had a child, are the exercises that actually, if done regularly, will increase the intensity of orgasm again. However, one friend and I were talking about it the other day, and she says, well, like, so how many? And I said, well, pediatricians sometimes say do 100 a day. And she said, well, I guess then you have to think about how many Kegels you wanted to do a day for how much quality of orgasm, right? Because now you have to work at it when you're not even excited.
Well, Mary Beth was responding in part to another question here. What works physically to help enhance or intensify the orgasmic experience? And those Kegel exercises are one of them. In case you're not aware of what they are, how you can find out is for women, when you urinate, if you start your stream and then squeeze the muscles of the pelvic floor to stop the urinary stream, start it, stop it, start it, stop it. That's a way to identify what the muscles are that you exercise. I say that's the way to find out. Every time you're urinating, this is not what you want to do. You just want to do this to find out what the muscles are. And then what you do is slowly contract those muscles, hold them for a count of 3, 5, 8, 10, and then slowly release them. And you can do that in different times when you're sitting and watching TV, if you're ironing, if you're stopping for a red light. I mean, you can do it for a number of times a day to get those 100 in, if that's what the gynecologist is saying is what it is.
Gynecologist, not pediatrician.
Yes.
Sorry.
Uh-huh.
It will also help with bladder retention and urinary retention as you get older.
Okay. In fact, that's what its original purpose was, in order to help spare women of surgery. Dr. Cagle had them practice tightening those muscles. And in the process, women came back and said, not only had it helped with the minor urinary incontinence that they came to complain about, but they had noticed that their sexual feelings were intensifying, and some of the women were experiencing orgasm that had never experienced it before. So it was a secondary gain from a procedure that was being requested for something entirely different.
There's one other question related, other answer related to this question, and that is, it's extremely important to know what medications you're on and what the side effect of those medications are, for both men and women. It's unfortunately a common experience on a number of the new antidepressant medications, Prozac, Zoloft, and so on. That's a double bind. But in any case, if you're too depressed, you're not interested sexually, if you're on this medication and have this particular side effect, then you may not become aroused. Or if you become aroused, you may not come easily to orgasm. It'll be either retarded ejaculation or may have the ever-frustrating experience, as many women report, of reaching the plateau phase and then not be able to come. And so it's important to not ascribe what is occurring or shifting for you personally to your person, to something about not loving yourself or your partner enough or not doing something right. It's important to ask the physical questions first and to check out all those particular side effects, or to also look at your life in terms of, are you in too stressful a period? Are you depressed? Has there been some recent crisis or change? Is there something going on in the relationship that is changing the quality of all of this? For women, the quality of the relationship is crucial to this. We haven't spoken much about men's functioning in terms of ejaculation and impotence and so on, but there are a lot of variables that are also as particular to men as we've talked particularly about with women.
Let me expand on the medication, because the SSRIs, these are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are the new antidepressant, the new generation of antidepressants, and are prescribed much more frequently and freely than the older generation of antidepressants are at this point in time, are notorious for their sexual side effects. They began in the PDR, with 2 or 3% of people taking them may experience the following. And the two major things that tend to happen is loss of libido and delayed orgasmic response. So that means men may not even ejaculate, or the ejaculation may be so delayed that with a long time of vigorous thrusting for intercourse, and you just kind of give out and feel like it's not going to happen, or it's very far away from happening. There are several ways now to medically manage these medications. First is you can live with it for a while, because sometimes for some people, between 3 and 6 months, their body adjusts and tolerates it, and the orgasmic experience returns. So that's one way of thinking about it. A second way is you can reduce the dosage and possibly still maintain the same antidepressive effects, or change the regimen, because it's found, and this requires a little bit of planning, if you're going to have sexual activity and you do it right before you would be taking the medication, or right after, during which some of the life of the medication has slipped, that works for people. They're now talking about a vacation from Paxil. You take it 4 to 5 days a week and not on the weekends. I don't know how that's working, and the data has not yet come in on that. Then you can switch to another antidepressant, because even if most of them have a similar effect, a different one may work for your depression, but also may not cause the same side effects. And now, when you think about it, it gets wearying. Physicians are beginning to co-administer a second drug to counteract the effects of the side effects of the antidepressant. And we can imagine that kind of going on ad infinitum. But those are the options out there. Let me state, there is one antidepressant on the market now, Wellbutrin, which has the least, not only sexual side effects, but probably the least side effects of all of the more recent antidepressants. It is not an SSRI. It doesn't work on the serotonin system. It works on dopamine. And Wellbutrin is not for everybody, but if that antidepressant will work for you there and you needed one, that would have fewer side effects.
There are also other medications that have sexual side effects. Medications for high blood pressure. In fact, there are probably 50 or 60 different medications. So you can check the PDR, which is the physician's desk reference, and you can call any pharmacist and ask about a particular medication, and he or she should tell you, or ask your doctor, or you can go to the library or to a bookstore and, you know, look this up yourself. And so it's important to ask the physical questions first and others next. Let's move on to another question. See if I can read this. It's quite light. This one?
There are two more parts to this.
Oh, sorry. So
what can enhance the orgasmic experience from a physical perspective? So one is checking out your health, checking out the medication, considering if there may be something that's interfering. The second is Kegel exercises. The third is an area of sexuality that we frequently keep even more personal, and that's our fantasy life. Fantasies serve a dual purpose. One, if we can fantasize, it helps refocus and reabsorb our attention, and we get involved in the fantasy and so therefore pay less attention to how our body is responding. And the less attention that we pay to how our body is responding, the more likely it is to respond as it should. And then the second part of that is fantasy is a mental sexual stimulation. And it also enhances and increases arousal. And fantasy doesn't have to be raw sex. For women, fantasies are often more emotionally, romantically involved than they are specifically sexual. So that may help.
In that area, there's a fairly good book that's been recently published called The Erotic Mind by Jack Morin, M-O-R-I-N, that has a long description of and ideas about how your own particular internal erotic self is organized and what are cornerstones of or excitement and what is the map, so to speak. What is your love map, a term coined by John Money. And how do you go from 0 to 60? And you actually can start to construct or look at more clearly how your internal fantasy life and thought life builds your sexual response and interest. And one of his ideas is that if you actually want to solve a sexual problem, go and look at your peak experiences very carefully, because then there is no problem. And look how it happens well or enjoyably, and find ways to repeat that again and again, rather than focusing entirely on what's wrong and what isn't working, which, after all, isn't as much fun anyway. We have about 15 minutes left, and so let's just answer some questions as quickly as we can.
I would like 5 minutes at the end to read something.
Great.
Actually, there was one question that I think related to that. The erotic mind would... this book might be very helpful for the person who asked this question. So often when I make love with my husband, it seems like I'm making love to a little boy, rather needy and graspy. He has stated that sometimes he feels like he is making love to his mother or a mother. How can these be changed? I think that this implied in this very question are that each partner has been sexually scripted very early in life. We all are. And probably implied in your question has something to do with the sexual scripts that were developed very early. And so I would say that the book that Mary Beth just mentioned, The Erotic Mind, may be a very useful book to flip through and help you identify what's happening in your situation.
I would also say that if both partners, as it seems in this question, are sharing their experience with the other, I feel this way when I'm with you at times, no, I also feel this way when I'm with you at times, that they have enough openness and trust in their relationship to say things that might be kind of sensitive or tender, which I congratulate them on. And if they would like it to be different, then they might enter a collaborative effort to say, when do we feel that it is different? When it is not like feeling like I'm your mother, or when is it other ways and other times? And oftentimes what will be happening is that there'll be a more collaborative or friendship or peer relationship going on about some item or some experience in the day, and then a different way of being sexual enters in or starts to occur. There's a different kind of play or a different kind of experience. In couples that are pretty normal and healthy, however, I'd have to say, there's a wide range of ways of approaching sex. You can be young at times. You can be old at times. You can take charge. You can yield and surrender. There isn't one map, so to speak, in terms of how it happens. One person can take charge. One can be small. One can be big. You can both be playing at it. You can play it being naughty or playing being, what, very sexual and spiritual at the same time? I guess you could do that even. Another question, quickly, is the real question is, do the general authorities masturbate?
Shall we take an anonymous survey?
I think I'm going to answer this question in this way, because none of us will ever know, will we? With a show of hands, how many of us think that... No, I really won't ask you to do that. Because there's no way of knowing, is there? I would assume, however, I will say that in terms of general authorities, that there's probably a wider range of behavior and opinions than we would guess, and that... In the past history of the church, certainly that wider range of opinions and experience was more widely expressed. And now, with the larger church structure, general authorities being more removed, we have a singular image of them, and yet I think they're still people. Do women's orgasmic experience change after having four or five children? I would guess that it might be more difficult to maintain those pelvic floor muscles after four or five children, that you'd have to keep working at it. But I don't have any evidence that that necessarily would make a difference. In fact, if you're in good physical health and all other things being equal, the question is, does the nature of your sexual relationship change, or your nature of your sexual self? Often, it's not unusual to have women with many children start to feel like they are a mother or their body is a useful object to get work done through the day. And so that your sense of sexuality or play or connection to your body or to your partner may decrease simply because it's crowded out and you have like 15 minutes at the end of the day before you go to sleep, something like that. It becomes one more thing on your task list. That, I would guess, is an issue as much as whether you physiologically change or not. Do you have any? Is that?
No. Only depending also how far spaced those five children are. If your fifth one comes along and you're close to 40 or 42 or 45, I think sometimes for many women, menopause is perceived as the time when there's the last period, but it's creeping up, and there may be some things that are happening physiologically that are causing some of the shifts.
And related to these questions, again, we receive questions mostly about women's functioning, but I have men ask me these similar kind of questions about themselves all the time, although I really experience men as having as great a difficulty as asking questions sexual in therapy as women do, and it may be because I'm a woman, and therefore that's a little more difficult than maybe asking a male therapist, I don't know. But the whole issue about erections and how they come more slowly in the refractory period from ejaculation until the next erection becomes longer. And if there are periods of illness or medication or whatever, those are, you know, so there are many, many questions. What I would say, given that we won't have time to answer all of those, one of the best things you might treat yourself to is to go to a bookstore, and there's several in town that have large sections about sexuality. Barnes & Noble does, Women's Place Bookstore does, University of Utah Bookstore tends to. Any large bookstore at the moment will tend to have at least a few. And, sit yourself on the floor and read, or browse through four or five and find which one works the best for you. One of the large questions I've seen for Mormons many times is, well, will I be learning things that won't be in compliance with what the church says? And I noticed that a lot of Mormons are very good at trying to figure out which TV programs will work for them or not, and which everything else. And so you can do the same thing with sexual. You can read what you want and then edit out or say, no, that's okay with me and that's not okay with me. And my experience is that in reading things quite explicitly sexual, particularly if you're an adult, is it don't generally harm you unless you think it's going to. If it's violent, that's another matter. But if you think it's going to, then you need to look at your own anxiety level about things sexual rather than there's going to be some information out there that's going to hurt you.
In general, knowledge is power, and you are entitled to exercise your selectivity and your free agency about how you deal with the information that comes in. How much time do we have?
We have about six more minutes. Let me answer one question here quickly. And what is the success rate with couples in therapy who experience great discrepancy in sexual desire? My husband and I have been married when we were both 37, and in our 8 years of marriage, we have had sex, never had sex more than 10 times in any 1 year. I'm going to leave the rest of the question out. But basically, I would say, and you know more about this than I do, that the wider apart the degree of interest is, the more that the couple are having difficulty about disagreement and not being able to solve those disagreements in all the other areas of marriage, and the more they're disidentified with each other, they can't pick up the other one's experience and really understand it, they can't take the position of the other, the more trouble you're going to have. Those couples who can talk about it with each other regularly, just see it as a matter of preference, there's nothing wrong with each person, it just is a matter of preference, that there are gender-related issues here, that they see it as something they need to collaborate on, are going to have a better success rate. They may not have sex as often as one would like, and they may have it more than another would, but they have a way of either turn-taking or finding ways of having affection where sex won't be involved for the person who is less sexually interested, but still be sexual for the person who is more. The crucial question is, for the person who is more sexually interested, do you have to have it in one particular way and then it's not good sex? And if it is that way, if you're pretty rigid or narrow about that, you're not going to get it the way you want it. You have to allow your partner who shows up for you sexually to be his or herself to a certain degree and allow some free play with that.
Okay. I'd like to respond to a question and then take a few minutes to read something.
Great.
It says, how do you know when you and your spouse are just needing to work things out and when you need professional help? I think that you really gauge the matter of the feeling of cooperation between you and the feeling of tension. If you're very polarized, if there's judgment involved, this one person's not normal or not fair or something's wrong with them, and there's a negative tone that is in the relationship over the sexual issues, then probably you need professional help. If you're cooperating, if you're brainstorming, if you find even but slowly you're making progress, even defined as simply understanding the other's position, even if nothing has changed in your sexual activity, then maybe you can continue to do it on your own. But also, if there are doubts and you are in that good position, it may be worth just a few counseling sessions, and that will just motivate you to continue down your own road rather than waiting till things may get antagonistic. And with that, I'll say I just will, when we're through, leave my cards and my colleagues' cards, and they're two different telephone numbers on both, but either of us can be reached through either telephone number. And if you have any questions or want to pursue something that's important for you, please feel free to give me a ring. I try to consider part of my work week as public education over the telephone for people, and I'm certainly willing to spend 5 minutes or so responding to any kinds of questions you might have that didn't get picked up today. And I would like to end, if it's acceptable with you, on to read a little bit, a page and a half about, on love. This was is by Stephen B. Levine, and it is published in the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy, Volume 21, Number 3, in the fall of 1995. And it says, 16 suggestions for promoting sexual health in long-term relationships. 1, have one. 2, develop your patience to simply listen to your partner speak. 3, make clear to your partner what you like to do in life without demanding anything. 4, stand accused of typically putting the good of the couple and the good of the partner ahead of your personal interests. 5, give your partner the benefit of the doubt when you feel that you have been mistreated. 6, speak frequently from the heart about subjects other than personal unhappiness with your partner. 7, keep all your personal ambitions in perspective. Most people do not actually achieve them. 8, value authentic sexual behavior highly, even the inevitable disappointments. 9, assume that your partner's perception that you are generally interested in satisfying your partner's sexual needs is vital to the growth of love. 10, love your body and its pleasures. Stop taking your bodily imperfections so seriously. 11, think of your sexual life as the camouflaged reenactments of your childhood pleasures and pains. 12, believe that integrity, honesty, and respect breed love, love breeds good sex, and good sex breeds love. It's a circle. Own and express your emotions, but don't always assume that they are the most important aspects of any interpersonal situation. 14, do not abandon your ideal of love just because your partner is currently falling short of meeting its requirements. 15, tell your partner how much you value loving and having sex. 16, behave as though you realize that, although you do not like to admit it, your needs to be loved are far greater